Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, last week I had two guests on, one of whom is about 25 years younger than me, and the other of whom is about 21 years younger than him. So we represented a baby boomer, me, and a member of what's called Gen X, and a millennial, which is also known as Gen Y. And we talked then about differences between those generations in terms of gender relations and communication styles, those two topics. But it can be hard to remember what generation is which. So at the start of last week's show, I gave a little rundown of the definitions, which go by year of birth. And in case you missed that show or just plain forgot, here's a primer on it again. Baby boomers were born between 1946 and 1964. The oldest ones are 18 years older than the youngest ones, so in some cases, I guess that means they might even be the parents of the youngest ones. Today, the youngest ones in that generation are 57. Those are the baby boomers. All right, so next is Gen X, also known for a while as the me generation, and they were born between 1965 and 1980, which is a slightly shorter span of years, I guess about 15. And today, they're middle-aged, so the youngest ones in that group of the Gen X are 41 years old. Next, the millennials, also known as Gen Y. Here's where it gets confusing. They were born between 1981 and 1996, so the youngest ones in Gen Y are now about 24 or 25. And finally, there's Gen Z, born between 1997 and 2015, and they're clearly too young to be on our show today. Did you get all that? I hope so. And so what we have for your show today is the three of us, the same three of us, your host, me, a definite baby boomer, and then Dr. Mike Stump, who's a Gen X business owner and entrepreneur and family man with a PhD in bioanalytics, which is kind of like biotechnology. And finally, Spencer Necessary, a 24-year-old millennial, or Gen Yer, who's a recent graduate of Virginia Tech with a degree in hospitality and tourism and is working at a country club in Tennessee to learn how to actually do what he was taught to do. So he's at the cusp between Gen Y and Gen Z, I guess. He's a ZY. Welcome, guys.
Good to be here, Court.
Yep, good to talk with you both again. So we'll do what we did last week, which is to talk about two topics during the show, since, again, I think that with three of us, it'd be hard to do more in half an hour than that, and we proved that last week by having to hurry up on the second part of it. Today, let's talk first about attitudes toward work and career, and then, more generally, we'll talk about our views on what the future looks like. Just starting off, when I graduated from college in the early 70s, it was the tail end of the counterculture, and a high percentage of my generation, at least the college types, didn't really want to settle down and take life seriously by working for a company or whatever. So a lot of people went traveling and backpacking around the world, and a lot of them just stayed in school indefinitely, never wanting to leave their womb and getting, you know, two or three PhDs or and a law degree or whatever. And I personally worked as a carpenter in France. I mean, I'd always worked. I'd worked in the summers, you know, from the time I was 14 or whatever. But after graduating, and I lucked out and lotteried out on the draft, so I didn't have to worry about that part. So I went traveling and I worked as a carpenter in France. I could speak French, and so that was interesting. And a chauffeur for the Mexican government. I spoke some Spanish, and that was also very interesting in a totally different way. And a screenwriter in Montreal, where, again, I could speak some French. So I did those things for a number of years before coming to D.C. and doing odd jobs, again, kind of an eclectic, diverse mixture of things, until I luckily fell into my first job that required my college degrees when I was 27 years old. And since then, I've been a career professional and am actually still working today and run a company today, not the radio show. But it was a very delayed start in my case. So, you know, I was 27, and I think the window was just about to close by the time I squeezed through it into having a professional career. So what about you, Mike? Did you have a delayed start at all, or did you jump right into the professional world after college?
Well, for me, I went the professional path since I had a PhD. So after undergraduate, it was right into grad school. But I think I would have loved to travel the world like you did, so I kind of split the difference. When I was an undergraduate in the summer times, I would move to the beach and I actually tried to play professional volleyball, which is kind of a silly thing for somebody who's only 5'8". But at least that way I got a little bit of an experience, you know, not so much traveling the world, but at least having a breakup from a solid academic path. But then once I finished my PhD, then I actually started my first biotech company. And from there, it's always been a professional career.
All right, so that sounds pretty straightforward then. And I guess, Spencer, there's not a whole lot of point in asking you the same question because I guess you just graduated a year or two back from college, but I assume you jumped right into your career.
When I got to college, and I worked all through college, each year and a half I would move around restaurants just to try to move up in the ladder to different opportunities, have different positions in the field, just trying to gear myself toward getting out of school and moving into my field more and actually climbing the management ladder.
Yeah, and of course, we all had to make a living after school. So in my case, I wasn't making a living at anything I particularly expected to do for the rest of my life or wanted to do for the rest of my life. But, you know, they were just kind of colorful jobs to knock around the world and avoid the real world. But in your case, you were following a path into the real world for sure. So that's good. And you still are. You know, and in previous generations, it was very common for people to go to work for a company and then retire from the same company 35 or 40 years later, you know, with the proverbial gold watch or whatever. And now I think that would basically never happen, partly because companies often don't even last 35 or 40 years anymore. But there had to be quite an evolution between those two extremes, right? So how do you see that, Mike? I mean, not necessarily from your own perspective as a more entrepreneurial person, as you described, but in general for your age group, is there an expectation to work a long, long time for a given company, or is there kind of a job hopping mentality?
No, I think in our generation, it was very much understood early on that working for the same company for a long time wasn't going to happen. I think it also depends on your career path. If you want to move up the management ladder, at least in my field in biotechnology, I tend to hop companies every 2 to 4 years. But I think if you want to be in middle management, you could probably stay at a company 8 or 10 years. But it does seem that people tend to move around from company time to time. I don't know of anybody in my age group that really can stay at the same company for more than 10, 15 years.
Spencer, do you see that as being something that people would, in your generation, would think about even doing, to work for a company for a long, long time, or is that just off the wall?
I think if you can get in good when you first get out of school and find a job that you really care about and you move up and you're comfortable, I think some people tend to stay in their jobs just because it's comfy. But I have other friends who work for like the prison systems, and they do not like that. It's just hard and strenuous work. But they get paid good, they get good benefits, they get good time off. But like, I don't think that would be worth it, honestly.
Well, it's probably not a common expectation in your age group that people want to work for the same outfit forever. They maybe want to stay in the same career. You know, that's a different thing, career changing. But I'm thinking that old thing of working for 40 years for Ford Motor Company and retiring with the little sad party and the gold watch is pretty much a thing of the distant past. Maybe another thing that's of the past is, for many generations, the boss or owner of the company was the unchallenged master, right? It was my way or the highway, and you could be fired summarily for no good reason, really, just at the whim of the boss, right? So gradually, I think it's gotten to where the manager is the mentor and the facilitator of the workers, and this is a combination of cultural things and legal things. But I mean, to some extent, he or she almost works for the workers now, or at least is a leader among equals. Do you see that as being true, Mike, in your field and in your experience?
So my experience, it's a very big thing now, to a thing called servant leadership. And that's kind of the it craze right now, which basically means is the boss does whatever they can to make sure the employee is successful. And in many cases, it's the job of, at least in my field, that I want to make sure that somebody underneath me is going to take my job in 2 to 3 years, just with the progression. So I think it definitely much changed. It's more of a team collaborative effort. You want to make sure we're accomplishing things as a team. And the way you offset that with the individual is having, you know, your own metrics or KPIs that you can deliver back. But very much servant leadership is the big thing these days.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at, you work for them. So that's completely and utterly different than it was 50 years ago. And it's both good and bad, I suppose. But when it works well, it's great, I guess. But when it doesn't work well, it's not so great. In your experience, Spencer, with the work you've done just in the last couple of years, do you feel that whoever's the boss is not really a hard boss or a tough boss, but it's more like asking your permission to tell you what to do?
I've had some tyrannical bosses who scream at people and tell them to do whatever they want. But I've also had bosses that are very composed and really want people to grow in their job. And like, it's very refreshing to get that. I think it, at some level, it kind of hurts workers that it's not very confrontational now. But I think it's definitely a better culture working now, because it is a nicer environment to work in. So it kind of helps people who maybe were more shy or timid to come into work and be able to flourish, as before, where they might be scared of their boss, and that really might just affect their work.
Yeah, I can see it both ways. I mean, you know, the idea of flourishing is good, but as you also alluded to, maybe you don't really learn in depth how to handle stressful situations, and maybe you're allowed to be softer in your work than you otherwise would be, and you're not learning how to handle tough situations. And I don't know, you know, it's kind of a toss up there.
Yeah, everybody's getting soft now.
Yeah, I know, that's true.
They're taking away Dr. Seuss and Mr. Potato Head. I'm hurt.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was thinking as you were talking, it's kind of like a parallel with parenting that, you know, parents over time have gotten less autocratic and more wanting to be the friend and mentor of their children than the boss of their children. And so there's some degree of that going along, too. I think it's a parallel thing. It's both good and bad. Anyway, well, you know, I think men used to identify themselves with their work to the extent that they were their work. They were their job, right? And it's not you are what you eat, you are what you do, more or less. And so now I think often they just work to pay the bills and don't have any sense of personal identity tied up in it. Or at least I'm sure there's a wide range. It goes from A to Z in that regard, but kind of the middle of the bell curve, I think, don't really identify with their work so much as they did in the past. Does that seem valid to you guys? Mike, maybe?
That's an interesting one because I'm probably a poor example of that. I tend to tie myself a little work, but I think that's the entrepreneur in me. I think when you're an entrepreneur, you tend to have to put that into a company because it takes that much effort to have a success. But at the corporate level, when I was in the corporate world, I would say I think there is a range. I think there is more of a work-life balance. I think that's very important for a lot of people. I think people want the company to do well and they take pride in their roles, but I think most people can leave a lot of the work at work for a lot more than they could in the past.
Hmm. What about you, Spencer?
I feel that's true, but I think it really depends on what job you have specifically. I mean, if you're a nuclear engineer, I feel like you take that home with you every day and that's how you carry yourself. But I mean, if you work in fast food, you might not want to associate yourself with that, or you might want to try to distance yourself from feeling that that's all you're really doing.
Yeah, it's valid. I mean, that was probably always true to some extent. But, you know, the higher status your work is, the more you identify with that status, I suppose. But I just think in general, probably there's less tendency to identify totally with what you do than you did in the past. Maybe that's partly because people change what they do to some extent, too, right? So, I mean, kind of following that line of thinking, at the same time, many young people seem to me, at least, to demand that their work provide fulfillment and a sense of self-worth. And I think we were talking a little bit about that before with the flourishing and flowering thing. But in other words, I guess that their work should please and satisfy them. And that wasn't the case 50 years ago. It was just basically what you did. And, you know, and if you're good at it, you were proud of it, but you didn't expect it to please you and fulfill you. I mean, those are terms that were unheard of back then, really. Would you agree that that's true today? Maybe let's start with you, Spencer.
I agree, that's true. I mean, I think most people, I mean, I think everyone works to make money so they can live.
Mm-hmm.
Most people.
But I mean, do you work so that you feel fulfilled and, you know, like your self-worth is improved and you're a whole person and, you know, or do you know people who talk that way?
I like my job because I get to talk to so many different people who are actually influencing the world or influencing the community. And I really take that from my job and that's something I take pride in.
That's good. That's a good point. How about you, Mike? Does that... You know, you're 21 years older and you're doing, you know, work that's more complex and bigger scale than Spencer is right out of school. But do you feel like your work should provide fulfillment and a sense of self-worth apart from just the pride of doing it and the money it pays and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I would say very much so. To your point, I think, at least in my generation, I think people really were the start of where people really wanted to make an impact in the world in a positive way. And I think they chose career paths based on enjoyment. And like, you know, you all said, we need to make money. But I think we were the first generation with our parents where they said, it's much easier to do a job that you love than a job you hate. And I think we were very selective of picking careers up front, not so much for the monetization piece, but for the enjoyment of the work. And then what was taught is if you really love the work and you're good at it, the money will come.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I've heard that for a long, long time too. So I think that's probably a good evolution in that direction, as long as it's not taken too far so that someone quits their work because it's not fulfilling enough to them personally. You know, there has to be a balance in the career path versus the personal fulfillment aspect of it, just like there is in work-life balance. But, you know, so kind of, again, another aspect of that, there used to be some people who were clearly driven by raw ambition, you know, just to be successful and mainly rich. In the 80s, there was a phenomenon of greed is good. You know, but you had to work to get there unless you inherited your fortune or whatever, you or got extremely lucky in the, you know, the startup dot-com company you joined 2 weeks ago or whatever. You had to work to get there. So there was a strong work ethic for a lot of people, even those who didn't especially feel an urge to get rich. So has that changed over time, you know, just basically being driven by ambition and an urge to make a lot of money? Is that, Spencer, again, in your age group, is that something that's looked down on or not talked about?
So I feel like that's different for each person. I feel like it depends on how your parents raised you. I was raised to where my parents told me I could do whatever job I wanted to do. And I mean, my mom was a lawyer and my grandfather was a judge. So, I mean, in the back of my mind, it was kind of always expected of me that I would go into the law field, but they told me I could do whatever I wanted. And I saw that work, and I mean, I saw the money that was coming in, but at the end of the day, I couldn't really say that I saw my mom as happy.
Hmm.
But she was making money.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do something that would fulfill me and make me happy, that I can go into work every day and not dread going into work. Just something I actually genuinely enjoy doing. I genuinely enjoy talking to people and learning about their lives and just shooting the bull.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying being on this radio show.
I am.
No, it kind of reminds me real quickly of a guy when I was like 28 or so and was living in Arlington, Virginia. And around the corner, there was a guy who had the big house, you know, this big mansion and gorgeous wife. And, you know, he owned three lots wide of a house, you know. And I got to know the guy because, you know, I would jog and he was a pretty cool guy. And he was a branch manager for Xerox at the time, for the DC branch of Xerox. So it was a pretty big job. And he had been given the opportunity to become a vice president and move to the corporate headquarters in Xerox. And we had a talk. We used to sit around, drink a beer and shoot the crap. And he said at one point, when he had that opportunity and he was mulling it over, he said, you know, what do you think I should do? I said, well, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. And he showed me a picture of the corporate structure kind of. And he said, you know, when I look up at the guys above me, I don't see any happy faces. And this was a, you know, good looking guy, good sense of humor, great life. He said, I don't see any happy faces. And I said, maybe you just told me what you want to do or don't do. And he said, yeah, I think I don't want to do it. And he went back to Alabama, where he was from, and started his own company, a smaller company. And I never was in touch with him after that, but I'm pretty sure he was successful and happy. I remember that. When I look up above me, I don't see any happy faces. You know, and that's kind of what you just said. So
I'm sure you've heard this, more money, more problems, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, Mike, why don't you weigh in on that?
Yeah, I would say from ambition, it's a mixed bag. I think there's some people who definitely wanted to be aggressive and have the career and do whatever it takes to climb the ladder. And I think there's other people who were just satisfied to just maintain the level they're at. You know, we definitely grew up in the 80s where I remember, you know, greed is good with Wall Street. And there was definitely that aspect to some things. But I think corporate structures changed a lot to try and be more balanced.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so there's a range of that. Well, like, do people today judge each other by their professional status as they once did? I think they probably don't, but let me ask you, Mike, what do you think? I mean, do people immediately judge people by where they are on the whatever organizational chart they're on?
I don't think so. I think more people are just conscious of it, in the sense that, hey, if you're at a higher level, I might just be more careful with my speech and make sure I come across well, and if I want a promotion or something like that. But in terms of, like, if we're friends and want to go have a beer or play golf, I think nobody cares as much anymore as they used to.
Yeah, okay. I think it used to be very hierarchical. I mean, it was like military almost before. And no, it's a lot less than that. I won't even ask you, Spencer, are you too young to... And in the field you're in, there's probably not a whole lot of hierarchical status stuff going on right now. But here's another question. Do you expect to be able to achieve what used to be called the American dream of home ownership and a comfortable retirement and all that? And, you know, and I think in my generation, definitely people did expect that. And, you know, they expected to end up better than their parents, and their parents expected and hoped that they would end up better than they did and that kind of thing. But, Mike, do you still see that as being very kind of pretty much broad based and universal in your age group, that people expect to achieve the American dream?
I would think, yeah, the expectation's still there. And I think for me personally, I think the biggest issue is, I think the home ownership is, and the retirement are two separate issues. I think most people know they can get the home and get going. I think the question is retirement. I think people thought they could get there, but with college tuition, depending on how many kids you have, I think the college tuition piece is really affecting what the retirement might look like. I think that's a tough question that a lot of Gen X have, is what do we do? Do we forego our own retirements to make sure our kids don't start with the debt that we had? Or vice versa, because there's a very big gap in, I think, people who are achieving the American dream if their parents were able to pay any portion of their college or not. I think there's a real divide with those parents who could help their children and those who had to do it on their own.
Mm-hmm. So what about you, Spencer? Do you even think in terms of the American dream and those components of it that are standard thoughts?
So I agree that retirement is going to be a problem for a lot of our generation. I mean, even for a lot of our parents in my generation, I think that money's becoming tighter and people are getting paid less and jobs are becoming more scarce that actually take care of you. So I think that we're going to see a lot of people working basically up until they die, which is very unfortunate, but I think that's the reality we're coming to.
Mm-hmm. Probably so. Yep. And even, you know, to the extent that people are still married and still living together and, you know, still alive as couples, maybe both people still working till one of them dies or both of them dies or whatever. Yeah, it's possible. Well, you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. And again, we're talking with three of us talking. I'm a baby boomer, and we're talking with Mike Stump, who is a Gen X person. And then we're talking with Spencer Necessary, who's in Gen Y, also known as millennials. We've been talking about attitudes toward work and career, but now we're going to talk about our views of what the future looks like in the remaining few minutes of our show. So when I was a kid, the U.S. ruled the world economically. And basically, we had it made. We had won World War II in our homeland. It wasn't called homeland back then, but you know, our nation had not been invaded, and we were untouched. And our industrial engine was a productive monster that, you know, that had grown like crazy during the war and benefited from it. So everything looked so rosy that you didn't even question the future. But the arms race with Russia, and particularly the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I was in Miami at the time, it was very close to home, right? Kind of put a cloud over all that. And then, you know, later on in the 70s and early 80s, there was a series of oil crises that made us feel like the future maybe wasn't so rock solid after all. And now, personally, I see the U.S. economy getting more and more shaky at a very rapid rate. And then there's climate change, which seems to be constantly throwing more and more extreme weather events at us. And then there's the extreme political division in the country, which is, you know, a very worrisome thing. So a lot of the future in general looks very shaky to me. So how do you see that, Mike?
Well, good for me. I guess I'm an eternal optimist. There is no doubt that we are in a transition time in our country for all the points you just made. But long term, I'm kind of optimistic. I think this is going to be a phase that we're going to go through. And I think once we get through the other side, it'll look good.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. You know, I tend to be an optimist too, but, you know, I guess I'm looking at things from a longer perspective too, from, you know, from that rosy world that I grew up in the 50s and in the early 60s. But so Spencer, does the future look shaky to you, or how does it look?
Oh, definitely. I think if you asked anyone in our age group, we would say that nothing is going right now, in a sense, like food shortages, economically, socially, just, I feel like everything is really coming to a head. And once we hit that head, we're going to hopefully be better, but we have a long time coming before anything happens, and we're going to have a major world event to actually see change, I think.
Yeah, and whether that world event is good or bad, I mean, you're 24, you've spent the last 4% of your life in a pandemic, which nobody ever expected before, right? So like, do people, you know, with that in mind, Spencer, do people in your age group, which is mid-20s, do they plan for the future? And if so, how far out do they tend to plan? Like, is the future a year?
I think we all try to plan for the future, but we don't really know what it's going to look like. So we're very unsure, like, with climate change and everything, we don't know what the world's going to look like when we're old and we want to have kids. Like, maybe I don't want to bring kids into this future.
Yeah, that was one thing I was going to ask you.
It might be a problem. I mean, I think there's too many people already, and I think that's part of the reason why we had a pandemic.
I agree, yeah. Mike, as a father of three, do you worry about your kids' future?
I do, but not in the same context of pandemics and other things, but that's because of my background. I play in biotechnology and actually had my own vaccine business at one point, so it doesn't worry me as much. But I worry more from, like what Spencer's saying, is from an opportunity point of view. I think my kids, you know, I really wonder what is the value of a college degree these days? Because we're forcing all these kids to go to college, but yet, I mean, I've hired several hundred, maybe even 1,000 people in the last 10 years in various roles and companies. And, you know, so you need a degree to get in the door, but it seems like the degree is not very well utilized in most job positions. So for my own kids, it's like, you know, college is getting so expensive. Is the ROI there? And it's like, I don't want to deny them the intellectual achievements. At the same time, their ROI in terms of the business prospect, it's hard to justify what major would even be there when you're looking at almost $200,000 a year for an undergraduate degree. So for the short term, college is tough. But long term, like Spencer said with that, I don't know what the opportunities are going to look like. But at the same time, I'm optimistic. I think our society is going to have some kind of shift. I think we're going to have to do that. And I think we're trying to figure that out. And I can see right now why it seems chaotic. But I think once we get through this, I think it's going to be, you know, interesting and smooth sailing. Not smooth sailing, but better than it is now.
So I was raised to where my parents told me that I have to go to college. Like, that is what I had to do. So I go to college, get a good job, right? Well, now what's happening is everyone's going to college and there's no jobs. We get out of school with debt and we're working for $10 an hour. You cannot pay your debt off and live working for $10 an hour. Like, that's not feasible.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's a hard reality right there. And it's hard to know what to say about that because you got a bump to get over, but it's not a bump anymore. It's a mountain. So, you know,
But Spencer, did you need the degree you have for some of the jobs you've had currently, or do you think you could have gotten those jobs without the degree?
In my field, I definitely could have gotten the jobs without the degree, but you really have to, it's who you know in my field. It, like, I went to school with girls whose parents work high up in Marriott, so they get out of school and they're like food and beverage director at Marriott or tourism director, or just thrust into these great positions. And a lot of people don't have those opportunities because it's really just the trickle down.
Yeah, but I would say definitely in your field, you could have gotten the job you have now without a college degree, but without a college degree, you can't get much above the job you have now. And so you will need that to move into management and to, you know, potentially owning a company and that kind of thing. Well, not necessarily potentially to owning a company, but definitely to move up within a company like the ones you just described at Marriott or whatever it might be. You know, your college degree is a prerequisite for that. But I mean, it is a question. I guess it becomes then, not everybody needs a college degree. It depends on what you want to do. And if you don't know what you want to do early on, then what do? You, I guess the fallback is to get a college degree just in case. I don't know. It's kind of a...
Yes, kind of a it's right? Double-edged sword.
Kind of a roll of the dice, but...
Yeah.
Well, we're kind of running short of time here. And, you know, I think, you know, we've talked about some of these things, like how about the political instability and divisiveness I mentioned at the beginning. But in my mind, that could lead potentially to a new civil war or even to the end of democracy in this country. I mean, it could be pretty dire. And so I don't know. How do you both see that? Mike, you're the optimist. Do you see that as a potential?
I don't know. I think it's interesting. I think there's been a lot of, you know, interesting documentaries rated on that topic, how the extremes on the left and right have gone either direction and the middle is getting lost, when for the most of the time the country's been in the middle. I'm not sure if that's true with social media. I think people are becoming more self-aware, and I think when people are more self-aware, I think they're going to come back to the center. And I think, you know, I don't think we're going to get anything to the civil war. I think most people know we don't want that, and I think we'll get back to the middle once both sides recognize what's going on. But I don't know what's going to lead that change. I don't think big media is going to do it. You know, Facebook and all those kind of guys. And I don't think the politicians can do it. I think it's going to come up to individual people like us recognizing our own, you know, faults and shortcomings and be able to come together like we are on this show and just talking through topics to get there.
I remember after 9/11, how suddenly everybody was much more friendly, and, you know, you would talk to people in the streets, and, you know, there was a sense of bondedness somehow after that. And, you know, maybe like Spencer mentioned just briefly a little while ago, that it might take some major world event, and maybe some really threatening, horrible major world event would wash away all this craziness we deal with now and put things in perspective and bring the country back together. I hope whatever that world event would be wouldn't be so massively destructive that there would still be a country to come back together. But I guess, you know, I'll end up with the same question that I asked you both last week. Are you happy being the age you are? Just briefly, because we're about out of time. Mike?
Absolutely.
Spencer?
Well, I know last week I said I would have liked to be a flower child, but at the same time, I don't want to reminisce on something that didn't happen. So I'd like to be in the moment for now and improve the world for what it's going to be, hopefully.
And you wouldn't necessarily want to be the age you would be if you were a flower child back then. But
no, I'd be almost done.
Anyway, well, that's good. So it's been a good show. And thank you both for being on. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.